Okay.
Here we are. It's July 11th, 1996. We're talking to June Pulsini, and this is the beginning of tape one. Hi.
Hi.
Hi. What I'd like to do is, you asked if we had some standard questions, and we do a couple of things just right off the bat. We walk through kind of your early childhood experiences, and the
how you became far? Just thinking back to 63.
Exactly.
How am I going to do that?
And things like that. But what we'd like to start off with is your birth date.
March 30th, 1940.
March 30th, 1940. Where were you born?
Pomona, California.
And when you were born, what were your parents doing?
My dad was. I have to think about that. I think they were in Ontario. My earliest memories, anyway. My mom was teaching school. They both went to Laverne College in those days. And my dad didn't finish. He became a barber. And he was, I think, at a barber shop in Ontario near Pomona when I was born.
And your
mother? And my mom was teaching.
Your mother was a teacher in the public schools?
Yes.
And
then soon he bought a walnut grove in Chino. And I know we lived in Chino, and she was teaching kindergarten, because as I was old enough to visit the kindergarten class, I remember doing that.
How did the walnut grove go?
Oh, the walnut grove was great. And we had, of course, we had cows, and we didn't have pigs there. I did that later. Chickens. You know, animals anyway, a little farm. Yeah, and that was during, you know, World War I, and my dad was a CO, so he didn't go. I guess he was almost going to, and they decided, I think he was growing corn and a lot of other produce there. So I think that...
He was exempted?
He was exempted to stay home.
But he was a
He
a
was
CO
a CO.
Because he was a...
Church of the Brethren.
Church of the Brethren.
Mm-hmm.
And how did you first... find out about IBS? I know that...
Galen.
Yes. Well, tell me about that.
When I was at Laverne College, I grew up and went to school in Glendora, all from kindergarten through high school, and then I went back and taught junior high there 1 year before joining IBS. And at Laverne, service was... important, and a lot of the graduates joined Brethren Volunteer Service, and if you happened to be a married couple, you were often assigned to IVS, which was related to BVS in that it was also a service organization founded to be an alternate service to the draft. And that was the main reason, although I had traveled during college and I knew I wanted to do some more traveling, so that was another incentive. But I had known Galen Beery since we were working at church camp in high school. And he had gone somewhat earlier and worked in Washington, D.C. and then in Laos and had come back, you know, and talked about it. And then there were others joining from my college, Kathy and Phil Walker. Ahead of us, at the same time, Dorothy and Al Basher, and then my ex-husband Ron Pulcini and myself. We went in the fall of 63, and happened to be, this is just aside, happened to be assigned to a team. When we were assigned to Cambodia, we didn't know where it was, you know. Is that a country in Africa? Or where, you know, we just had some idea, but we quick, you know, got out our books and looked it up, and at that time, there was a team of 10 English teachers recruited. And so we didn't go to BVS orientation at all. We went straight to IVS with Dorothy and Al Basher and a Lucy Hollinger from Pennsylvania. So 5 out of the 10 were Brethren. And we were told they had to do a special security check to make sure we weren't proselytizing or had some other agenda other than just going to teach and work.
You were told this by IBS at the orientation?
I don't remember now where. I think maybe we were told that when we got to Cambodia. that they were kind of curious that so many of us were brethren.
Yeah, but the they being?
USAID.
USAID, mm-hmm. Okay. Backtracking just a slight little bit. Why were married couples who were brethren assigned to IVS? Why?
Well, Brethren Volunteer Service didn't have the positions, always have positions available for couples.
Couples.
My cousin, David Deal, who happens to be Chinese historian at Whitman College, mm-hmm. He and his wife were assigned in BVS to Japan, mm-hmm. and while I was in Vietnam, went to their seminar called Conflict and Reconciliation in Asia. Mm-hmm. And so once in a while, so they did have some positions, but not as many as IVS had at the time. And at this time, I think for some reason they preferred married couples because of they had added women. You probably get some of the first women on the IVS teams to talk about their problems. Mm-hmm. But there were problems with single women, and yet they needed women in mm-hmm. jobs there. So I think that it just worked out that IVS had more positions for couples.
When did you first become aware that IVS had contracted with USAID to provide personnel?
When we got to Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. We went under the assumption that IVS was private and Peace Corps was government, and that we would therefore be more independent than Peace Corps would be from the government. It turned out not to be true.
Not to be completely true or as true?
Well, not to be true at all. Uh-huh. As a matter of fact, we knew a lot of the Peace Corps people in Thailand when we lived across the river from them in mm-hmm. Takek later on. This is later. Mm-hmm. But they, in fact, were not as closely tied as we were. But it depended on which country. Mm-hmm. It varied greatly, which I can go into later. It varied greatly between Cambodia and Vietnam and Laos.
Yes, definitely.
And in Cambodia, we were directly contracted to USAID. They did our orientation. Mm-hmm. All the orientation things that we went to were State Department. We knew they had done security clearances. Mm-hmm. And our assignment was to teach in lycées, in the provinces in Cambodia, and replace Cambodian teachers so that they could come into Phnom Penh and receive language training, English. They were teaching written English, but not conversational, so they could have intensive training while we covered their positions in the schools. And the schools in Cambodia had French and Russian teachers, but they didn't have English teachers. And the reason Prince Sihanouk wanted English teachers was they had held a Buddhist conference and found that their neighboring Buddhist countries were English-speaking, not French. And at this time, Cambodia was French-speaking. It was the official language, and all the officials, all the government spoke French. And since we were to live out in the provinces, we had a Cambodian language training when we arrived in Cambodia.
How long was that?
That was scheduled for 3 months. Mm-hmm. And it was a wonderful time because we went to classes. We went to classes and teaching English as a second language in the morning. Mary Gray, who was with the Binational Center there, was the teacher. And then Dick Constantino was the USAID education person in charge of us. He had been a Fulbright teacher, spoke Cambodian fluently. He was wonderful. And what he did with us was, and I think Dale Pirtle was the language teacher. In the afternoon, we had language class. Mm-hmm. We lived in a house in Phnom Penh together, and when people came in from the agricultural stations and so forth, we would meet them. Every weekend, we had field trips to go to the schools where we would be assigned. Mm-hmm. So I saw more of Cambodia, and Cambodia in peacetime was just, you know, wonderful, beautiful place. We just, I still have probably the most fond feelings for Cambodia because of the times that we had there. We went to the beach at Kep. We were assigned to Siem Reap, right by Angkor Wat. We thought we'd be living there for 2 years. We drove up there. We could drive everywhere in the countryside and not worry about security.
What year did you arrive in Cambodia?
63 in September.
September.
Oh. Of course, you know what happened. November 63. I'll never forget it, the knock on the door and that Kennedy was assassinated. And, of course, prior to that, Ziem was assassinated. Sihanouk got crazier and crazier, and we could hear him on the radio ranting and raving about he would go off and on anti-American. He was sure that we were funding secret radio broadcasts that were opposing him. Hmm. And we would ask if we were, and we're told no, we weren't, and then later on we found out we were. But in the meantime, we went through some real hostile periods there. And in fact, one of my Cambodian brothers, when I've shown him pictures, says, see that little kid over there? I was one of those little kids throwing tomatoes at your apartment buildings. And I said, well, we weren't in that one because they had demonstrations. And then the American aid program was kicked out by December.
December of 63.
And because we were contracted with AID, we had by then picked out our house. It was a house in Siem Reap that Mike Vickery had lived in, and had met the principal at the school where we were going, and were looking forward to being there 2 years and having all that time to soak up the history of Angkor Wat. And we were really disappointed. And also had hopes that maybe somehow private funding could be found so we could stay, because Sihanouk didn't want us to leave. So there were a lot of Americans who were there teaching at the Binational Center, and we were taking their places, taking their classes as they left. Mm-hmm. And then we're among the last to leave. And Marty Klisch, an IVS who was later killed in Laos.
That's could you spell this?
C-L-I-S-H. Mm-hmm. He had been there and was at a community just outside, called Churidong, outside. I have wonderful pictures of us singing inside of a rainstorm. Kind of a side benefit of having gone to Laverne College, and Dorothy and Al Basher had, we sang in an a cappella choir. And I'm an alto, and Ron was a tenor, and Dorothy was a soprano, and Alan was a bass, and we had a quartet. So we used to sing, and my ex-husband played guitar, so we had a good time going to village festivals and entertaining. And we got caught in a rainstorm, so we went inside of a shelter by a temple, and have a great picture of us all soaking wet and singing for crowds of Cambodians. And so we had some really wonderful times. And we also had a Vespa motor scooter that we rode around, and got to visit outlying areas around Phnom Penh, which was never really could be done safely in any place we lived after that. And Marty got funding to stay, so he stayed in Cambodia. The rest of us were told, George Eason was the, they called chief of party then, the IVS director. And of course, gradually, all the IVSers came in from the field, and we had this crowded house. I want to tell you something else that may not be in your questions, but when we left Washington, D.C., we were sure that we were going to live with the people in the country where we were going. That we would, when we got off the plane, we thought we'd probably never see a Western toilet again, you know, that we'd be living as Cambodian villagers would live. And what happened was a reverse culture shock, because the house that was the IVS house, there was a nice villa, and we were sharing a bathroom, but we had nice rooms, and a wonderful cook, and great food. Then what happened was, because we were going to be assigned to the provinces, all of the officials in USIS and USAID and the embassy wanted to meet us. So we were entertained, and we didn't have clothes or calling cards to fit the protocol of what was expected of us. And so that was a big shock to find out all of a sudden. In fact, the men had to have white suits made because we were invited to sit on the Queen's barge for the water festival. And so it was like what I'd like to call a reverse culture shock. Instead of having to deal with the culture of a Cambodian rural town, we were dealing with the U.S. diplomatic culture. And at the beginning, they had an ambassador there who even wore his coat and tie, and we were told that that meant anybody in the room with him had to wear a coat and tie, even if it was 120 and boiling. So we had to learn to deal with the protocols of the diplomatic service rather than the life of a village. Although we did get out to village because of our Cambodian language teacher. He invited us to a wedding, so we had some experience eating and visiting while we were still in Cambodia. But our group was then split between Laos and Vietnam. And Christmas that year, New Year that year, we went to Vietnam where we met Don Luce and decided we would stay there.
So in December of 1963... USAID was kicked out of Cambodia.
Yeah.
And when were you transferred over to Vietnam?
Well, we went, I think all of us went to Vietnam initially, and I think we went to the Christmas in Da Lat with the Vietnam IVS team.
In 63?
In 63.
Okay.
We were there for Christmas. And then Don looked at where we could be placed, some of us could be placed in Vietnam. And then there were others that just didn't want to be in Vietnam, and they went on to Laos.
One second. That's Don Luce, L-U-C-E.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. So you went to Da Lat. That's D-A-L-A-T.
Yes.
And you met with Don, and he was involved in trying to place folk in the rest of Southeast Asia.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so we were placed at Bao Loc, at a agriculture college that had been built by the University of Michigan.
Mm-hmm. That's B-A-O-L-O-C.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And where was that near?
Wow. It is, it was on the road on the plateau between Saigon and Da Lat.
On Da Lat.
In the Central Highlands.
Uh-huh.
And there were two IVSers already there, Bob Knirschild and Steve Zadik.
Mm-hmm.
And they lived in an IVS house near the campus. The campus, having been built by the university, had a wonderful library,
mm-hmm.
all in English. And so they needed more English teaching so that the students' proficiency would be at the level that they could utilize the library. And the housing was built Australian style,
uh-huh.
and we lived in the housing of the for the faculty of the college.
Uh-huh.
So it was standard.
Now, could you go back to the Michigan presence? What was that?
University of Michigan built this agriculture college,
mm-hmm.
and I found out later, and I haven't been able to follow up on it, that a prominent person in L.A. by the name of Stanley Scheinberg
mm-hmm.
Was part of that team
mm-hmm.
from University of Michigan. And they had programs in public safety, and then they built this college and established it as a university-level agriculture school
mm-hmm.
because of the need to upgrade agriculture. And unfortunately, they couldn't get the professors to live in Bao Loc because of security fears. There was a German forestry teacher. There was a professor who had been at the University of Florida. Most of Vietnam's educated elite were French educated. And those who were educated in the United States didn't feel they had the status. And one thing we learned later was that most teachers preferred to be in a capital city because that was where the best schools were and students and status. And to be assigned out in the boonies to a lovely little college out in the middle of, tea and coffee
mm-hmm.
plantations, was not popular.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually what happened, it was reduced to high school. level and we were moved. That's down the road. Right now, at the time we lived there, it was fairly secure, although, and we drove between Saigon and Baloch and Dalat. We were warned not to keep a schedule. One of the cars was shot up. Steve's car was shot up. He was going out to dig wells in some Simonyard areas.
Steve said it.
Yeah. And that car happened to be a day he wasn't in the car. And so it was assumed that was a warning not to keep a schedule and not to carry a weapon, because they ask for the American with a weapon. So someone knew that Steve was carrying a weapon. And so then also, we don't know, because IVSers didn't usually carry weapons. Mm-hmm. Maybe he was feeling the insecurity of that area. I don't know, but it was after that really noted that we shouldn't carry weapons.
This
because
was
that made
64?
Us. This was early 64, yeah. Mm-hmm. Because then we could be target. Mm-hmm. And it was mainly felt that if we were identified as IVS on the vehicle and everything, that we wouldn't have any problems. Don, though, told me a story, and I think it was probably towards the beginning of our stay in Vietnam. He took us to sing at orphanages in different places. Mm-hmm. And we went to a Buddhist festival in a town outside of Saigon. And he just told me maybe 10 years ago about this, what really happened. But we went out there, and it was big crowds, kind of oppressive, as you know, Vietnamese don't have body hair like we do, so all the kids were, you know, pulling the hair in our arms, and we really enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun, but it was kind of our first experience with a real crowd of people that were, and we were oddities, obviously, and that night, for some reason, Don told us that we needed to stay in a nearby army camp. And the captain and his wife gave up their room for us, so we stayed in their little board bed with a mosquito net. And we thought how gracious and hospitable of them, and, you know, to host us for the night. And we thought it was a little odd, but didn't really question it until a few years ago, Don said, "You know why you stayed there? Because our driver said that this was all Viet Cong area and it wasn't safe for us to drive back to Saigon that evening. And he recommended that we stay in this camp for the night." And I think many years later we have found that he is still living at the IVS house, and that he was actually on the other side.
You mentioned he was still living at the IVS house.
The driver.
The driver.
Mm-hmm.
And so you find yourself at this agricultural college.
Yeah.
And it's in a relatively secure area. It's a very salubrious place. I'd imagine it must have been at least at, 1,000 feet? 700 feet? You're growing tea and coffee around there?
It was beautiful. Mm-hmm. And there was a French plantation. On the campus was a MAG, a military advisory group, that showed movies and invited us to their movies and their parties. And we got our mail. IVS was not as directly connected to AID in Vietnam as it was in Cambodia. Although that was our funding, we were working with the Vietnamese school system, with Vietnamese counterpart teachers. But we did get our mail through APO. We didn't have commissary privileges. We ate our food from the local economy, from the market. When we went over the airstrip was at this tea plantation, and we would go over there sometimes to meet the planes, and the family that was there was very hospitable and had been there for many years as tea growers. And I can remember one of the guys from the military group telling my husband that now that he's been in Vietnam and learned Vietnamese real well, watch out, when he goes home, he's going to be drafted. And he explained to him that he wouldn't be, because he's doing his alternate service to the draft now, that he was a CO. And the guy just looked at him and said, "You're not one of those yellow bellies, or you wouldn't be here." he just totally discounted it, discounted what he told him. And they were nice, too. They'd include us, and once in a while, like, the province chief invited us to dinner with military officers. Mm-hmm. And they would all get sick, and we wouldn't, because we were used to the food by then, and mm-hmm. they only ate from the commissary. Mm-hmm. The flights would bring in their...
What was your first impression of that MAG group there?
Those guys were military, they volunteered to be there, and they told me, you're teachers, you want to teach, we're soldiers, we want to fight, and this is the only war we have. And they would go out and come back bragging if they got in some action, and they could get a little, you know, ribbon or combat thing, you know. I mean, they were really gung-ho. We saw it change as they brought in draftees. And the first guy that came in that was drafted said he was a civilian at heart. And he really wasn't part of these guys. And they really liked socializing with us. And it was hard to turn them down because we liked having an American meal once in a while, too. Mm-hmm. And it was nice to see a movie. There wasn't any, except for Steve and Bob and their house, there wasn't any real social life there. So that became a part of our
How large was the IVS team besides Steve Zadek and Bob?
Knerschild.
How do you spell that?
That's a hard one.
Oh, just
K-N-O-E-R-S-C-H-I-L-D.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. So besides those two, how many were there of you? There was you and your husband.
That's it. Uh-huh. There were four of us.
Oh, that was just four?
Yeah.
Well, no wonder.
And also, the USAID people who came were afraid to stay overnight there. Because of security.
Even
it was very strange,
even
though we lived there,
yeah.
And the MAG team was there,
uh-huh.
Yeah, they were worried about security. And this is why Vietnamese didn't like to teach there either. And I found out later, I had a conflict because I love the flame trees. And where our house was, there were trees along the road, mm-hmm. And there was a tree in front of our house. And I had a confrontation with a man in a bulldozer who came to knock over the tree, and I went out and convinced him to stop that I wanted the tree. And then I was called in by the administration at the college and told that that was a terrible thing that I did because they have to take this tree down so there won't be shadows for Viet Cong to hide in at night. And they put up a security fence. They put up a security fence then. And lights on our house so that it would be all lit up around the house so it would be secure. Well, of course, just a few hundred feet over was just jungle. You know, it was like we were on the edge. I think we were the last house or there may have been one other house. Uh-huh. So after this, we'd hear noises at night and our dog would bark and we'd think, uh-oh, maybe this is it, you know, if something was going to happen. And one night, particularly, it was really scary because we could hear footsteps outside. And the dog was barking, and we shushed the dog. And I can't remember if we hid. I know we got up and went someplace away from the windows. But then we heard a lot of chickens squawking in the next door house, mm-hmm. And figured it was somebody stealing chickens. It wasn't going to be someone, you know, lobbing a grenade in on us or something. But they created that kind of fear atmosphere, mm-hmm. because there was so much worry about security. Then after a while we were told that we shouldn't travel any place without an escort from the military group, mm-hmm. Which we didn't pay attention to. We just went.
Where did you go when you went?
To Saigon.
Uh-huh.
Or to Dalat. To Dalat.
You just drove in IVS marked vehicles?
I think it was marked.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
we
just drove.
So, yeah.
And the other person who would come there is John Summers.
Mm-hmm.
John wrote the book with Don, mm-hmm. Unheard Voices.
Yes.
And has been involved over the years with IVS. Mm-hmm. And he would come there because he was building and working with Mountaineer Training Centers. And that was the summer project while we were there. Ron helped to build a dormitory at one of the schools.
Could you explain that, the summer project?
This was during the summer vacation of the school, so we weren't teaching classes. We had a Vietnamese counterpart that was working with Ron. I wasn't as involved in this. And I had conversation groups that came to the house. Mm-hmm. But he was building this out of mud cement bricks. They had a
dormitory?
The dormitory. Mm-hmm. So they were building the bricks, making the bricks, mm-hmm. drying the bricks, and then building the dormitory. Mm-hmm. And he was doing it with the Vietnamese counterpart, and it was part of John's program. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's about all I know. Ron knows more about it. Mm-hmm.
Well, what was your daily regimen when you were at the school?
Wow. that's going back.
Mm-hmm.
We had a cook there that made meals for us, and then I think when I first got there, I made curtains for the place. And we were assigned our classes, and basically we were teaching. But I can't remember even how many hours a week we were teaching. Strange. Wasn't real demanding, and we spent time with
meetings with the teachers?
With the students. Conversation classes with students. And we visited in the evenings with the professor that came from Florida. Although he went to a conference in Switzerland and then never came back. There was a German forestry teacher.
Mm-hmm. But your duties actually were...
Our duties were classroom teaching.
Teaching...
English.
English at the conversation. High school... Conversation. At the high school level?
College.
At the college
this
level.
This was
right.
A
Sorry.
College, yeah. College, right. Yeah. And then also we were learning about the agriculture side of it. One of the things that appealed to me is I'd been in 4-H and raised pigs, and that was one of the projects at the college. They had animals, and they had... something happened there, which I have pictures of, that I'm still not sure about. We did go out with, and I'm not sure who we went with, to North Vietnamese refugee villages.
Mm-hmm.
There were Kaha and Rade, mm-hmm. Tribes people
That's
in the area.
Right. Okay. Could you spell that quickly?
I have a Kaha friend here, and I don't remember how to spell it. I think just C-O-H-O.
I think so, and it's just
yeah.
R.
Chil was one of the subgroups.
Uh-huh.
Rade was R-A-D-E.
R-A-D-E.
Mm-hmm. And so we knew some of those folks. We went out to these North Vietnamese villages that were Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And
Catholic,
I have a picture.
Catholic emigres that came down from the North under a CIA program to
in
54. Resettle them
yeah.
in 1954.
Mm-hmm. And they actually, I've learned more about that since from a Kaha friend that has a bakery restaurant right here in town.
Uh-huh.
We never totally lose contacts. his family lived outside the lot, and he explained too that they were actually moved off of land for these Vietnamese that came in. There's a lot of resentment between the Hill Tribe people and the Vietnamese. And you should talk to one of the IVSers was held captive by Montagnard that went to Cambodia with us. Forrest.
Curtis?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm going to see him this weekend, on Monday.
Is that Forrest?
Well, maybe it's not.
No. I have to think about that.
Uh-huh.
He's been with AID since.
I know.
And anyway, he knows about that conflict from living with the... in that area. One of the things I have a picture of, but I have no memory of, was that we were taken to a hamlet that had been overrun. I was very naive about the whole military situation there. And so this hamlet was overrun and accidentally, because what they did is they gave us money to hand out to people. And I have the pictures of me, you know, handing money to folks. Mm-hmm. And I really don't know why. And maybe Ron would remember more about it. I don't know. Except that it was a hamlet, and they had built strategic hamlets uh-huh. with all the spikes around them.
Uh-huh.
And we did visit hamlets. That wasn't our job. But, you know, we were taken out there.
And this was a Catholic village?
The hamlet? I don't think so.
Did you just remember going to...
I remember going to...
To various
uh-huh. Areas that were Catholic villages. Uh-huh. And in Dalat, the USIS person there became friends. They invited us up to stay with them. And we could drive up on a weekend. Uh-huh. Yeah, I have a picture in one of the IVS annual reports uh-huh. of us at a table with Moton Yard kids uh-huh. at this USIS home. And my friend here looked at that picture and told me the names of one whole group that were a little older. I thought for a minute he was going to say he was in the picture, uh-huh. but they were all classmates of his. And unfortunately, my memory doesn't work real well. But there were a lot of villages around a lot that when we'd have our Christmas meeting, we'd sing Christmas carols. Okay. Don would take us out to different Moton Yard villages and sing carols. And you'll probably be talking to some of the guys that were stationed in Dalat mm-hmm. and working outside in these areas.
The annual Christmas meeting?
Yes.
Could you annual, describe those?
Yeah, we met at the university and we stayed in the dormitory and all the IBSers from all over Vietnam came for a Christmas meeting. Mm-hmm. And it was a time when people could share their work and their problems and just enjoy each other. I wasn't there for the notorious one when the story was that Madam Nu learned the word barbecue from IBSers, which she described later
yeah.
when the monks were immolating themselves. But evidently she was at one of the IVS barbecues at Christmas.
An IVS barbecue at Christmas. Yeah. Of course, that would have yeah. happened.
That was previous to us. That was earlier. Yes. That was one of the stories that was handed down to us about
it's an urban
Christmas
myth
meetings.
Amongst IVS
yes.
was that Madam Nu
learned the word,
about American barbecues
yes.
from these the Christmas
yes,
meeting.
Yes, from the Christmas meeting.
Yes. Did you have a barbecue when for a Christmas meeting you attended?
Not one that I attended.
Huh.
No.
So we.
And I just attended.
It remains an urban
two
myth.
Of them. Yeah, uh-huh. It's an urban myth. It's uh-huh. one of those stories that are handed down in IVS. And you talk to enough people, you'll find somebody that was there.
Oh yes.
Somebody told me that
was
there.
Madam Nu there.
No. Yeah. Somebody that was that she was.
Someone that Madam Nu
yeah.
once was in Dalat.
Yeah. Somebody that was in Dalat. I did talk to the person who uh-huh. saw that firsthand.
Uh huh. That Madam Nu was actually mm-hmm. attended one of
yeah.
these
yeah.
Christmas things and therefore
yeah.
might well have
yeah.
learned that word. Then.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
we'll have to track
it. Yes, yes.
Yes.
Yeah. And there were, because of the problems of the student body and the professors, the August of 64... we had planned our vacation to go to Japan to this conference mm-hmm. that my cousin in BVS had organized, mm-hmm. Conflict and Reconciliation in Asia. Mm-hmm. So we went on military air transport, space available, mm-hmm. with a friend, Carly Allender, who is Carly Numi now in Philadelphia with the Quakers. Mm-hmm. And she went with us, and we went to Japan, landed in the air base there, and her family friend was the general in charge of the air base. Mm-hmm. Friend of Ron's from high school happened to be on that base also, and visited them, and they went to the seminar, which was 2 weeks, with students from 11 countries. Mm. And part of it was in the mountains outside of Tokyo, and then we went to the anniversary of at Hiroshima on August 5th mm-hmm. and went to fly home. And we're told that we'd have a better chance getting on a plane out of Okinawa. So we went over to Okinawa and spent the night in the airport waiting for a plane. And I couldn't go on a plane that didn't have a bathroom. So we were knocked off. As we were waiting, a typhoon came in. And we watched that airport evacuate. Incredible planes, three at a time, the B-52s. And when we saw all of this, we thought, uh-oh, you know, this is going to be used. Mm-hmm. Up until this time, it was just advisory teams. After the typhoon went through and they put us up in a BOQ for the night.
Bachelor's officer quarters. Uh-huh.
After, because we had spent our money, we thought we were flying home, mm-hmm. you know, so we were run out of money by then. And then went back, Tonkin crisis had happened, and every plane leaving there was filled. So we ended up after, I think, another night in the airport on Kadena, I wired Don Luce, and he sent us a ticket to go. We paid for our way home then. Flew back to get back to what we thought was school starting, but it turned out they decided to reassign us to Way instead of back to Balloch. So that fall we taught in two different high schools in Way. Mm-hmm. I was at Wintry Fung and Ron was at Quilcock. Mm-hmm. And we went to live with Mary Beth Clark, who was in an IBS house that had been established in Way. And that was 64, and then we were teaching there. When the students were demonstrating, we went through the demonstrations there, and the USIS library was burned. Mm-hmm. The USIS director there we had known from Cambodia. He mm-hmm. had happened to be the one that was in Cambodia when we were there. Mm-hmm. And then...
Any reflections on those revolts?
Our students were great. We had a group, too, that met outside school for conversation. Mm-hmm. A teacher that I worked with, I'm still friends with, she lives in Hawaii now, and we did a lot of things. Oh, there's too many reflections. We can go on for days.
Oh, yes, no. It's just this is a very poorly examined, and 64 is a poorly examined year, and the Buddhist revolts in Way are poorly understood events.
Oh, okay.
And just for the record, I was interested how
we perceived them.
And how yeah. your students might yeah. have described them.
Yeah. Well, our students, and I think some of their slogans described it, mm-hmm. they wanted Vietnam for Vietnamese to solve. Mm-hmm. And most of the revolts were against, this one was against the Hung administration. Mm-hmm. As you know, in that period of time, there was a coup.
Right.
Often. Several times we were caught in Saigon. Mm-hmm. IBS House was out at the edge of town where the tanks started rolling in from, mm-hmm. so we always knew at the beginning, mm-hmm. uh-oh, here they go again. Mm-hmm. Which one is it going to be this time?
Well, what did Vietnamese for the
and
Vietnamese to solve mean?
Well, they felt that the U.S. was controlling things, mm-hmm. and that they wanted control, and the Buddhists, for the most part, there was a monk who was a leader there by the name of Thich Truy Quang, mm-hmm. and I know of one case where Jerry Rose, a reporter for Life magazine, had been there and interviewed him about their philosophy and their neutrality, and had the article approved, and then when it came out, it was totally different. Mm-hmm. They were continually being portrayed as pro-communist. We could sit in our house with students, a Buddhist and a Catholic, and they would both be telling us that the other ones were communists and not even hear each other. It was amazing, the lack of communication. Since the end of the Diem regime, the cathedrals that were in process stopped. Because there was no longer cement available. So obviously a lot of the aid and stuff was going to the church during that period.
From the government.
From the government. Mm-hmm. The Buddhists and the students in Hue were just wanted, I think they wanted to be neutral, they wanted to negotiate, they wanted peace. And I don't think they were communists. I think they were patriotic Vietnamese. Mm-hmm. In fact, I know a lot of them weren't, because I think even now, Thich Thuy Quang was under house arrest under this government. Mm-hmm. And so even though, and I found this true with a lot of student friends that were critical of the government, were not part of the new government once it happened. They were alienated from that because they were just independent thinkers and critical. And they didn't fit either way. You know, they wanted more of a democratic solution. And at that time, when this was going to happen, our students came to us. We lived actually outside of the secure zone of Hue, across a canal that was in the... The military guys were dating the single woman that lived with us, and they weren't supposed to go across that canal. Yeah. And we also were told not to go out to the tombs or anything, but students took us on their motorbikes. To visit, so we did get to visit some of the areas. Mm-hmm. And we went by boat up to the Tien Mu Pagoda during Tet that year with IVS friends visiting us. And we hid back inside the boat to go past the guards, past the what was considered secure to go up there. And there were firefights right there. During that Tet, we were at a restaurant that we thought there were firecrackers going off, and it was a squad of VC at a canal across from us. We didn't realize it till the restaurant emptied, and we thought, uh-oh, I guess we better go. But it's strange how when you live in a place, you feel immune. You feel like the fighting's going on over there, and not, you know, we're not a part of it. But the students told us about the library to tell the Americans not to have armed guards, to let there be a demonstration. And in fact, Ron was in it. He should be telling this. When the demonstration went by and they came in and they burned the library, they left the USIS director's office intact with his camera and everything. Nothing was touched in his office. So, and they didn't have armed, they didn't have any shooting or any death. They said, tell them that, you know, you can replace the books, but that it'll escalate if there's violence. And I don't know, it was a curious place. They also attacked homes of some of the Vietnamese government people. They pulled everything out of their houses and put it in the front of their house and burned it. So during this time and this unrest, they put guards on our house, and then they moved all the women and children into a safe house. Mm-hmm. And I think I spent one night in the military compound besides the safe house because they didn't know what was going to happen because it was just a lot of turmoil. And so there was times there where it was uneasy and we didn't know if we were going to stay or if we were going to leave. And then after that Tet that year, when the planes came over really low, bombing the north, and the day that happened, it was very evident what had happened. And the next morning, I was given 2 hours to get some things together and meet at the airstrip by the Citadel and be evacuated. And I went because I was married. I didn't have a passport there because they had it at IVS. But all of the IVS wives were considered dependents, not employees, according to some government rule. The single women who were working as teachers were okay. They were not dependents. But when the edict came down, evacuate dependents, then that was it. And we argued, and because I was working, and they said, no, you're out of here. And so I was on the plane, the first one out of Da Nang, evacuation in 65 to Hong Kong. And we had the dilemma of having to finish 2 years alternate service. And
well, Ron did.
Ron did. Well,
right.
We did, because I also
was committed to two years. Contract,
yeah,
right.
And committed to 2 years. So that was why we ended up. When we were in Hong Kong, we met friends, the Bashers, who had been in Cambodia, had gone to Laos, mm-hmm. and they just said, "Well, why don't you come to Laos? And you know, if you extend one more year, a whole year from that time." You know, they had a place in rural development in southern Laos where they could use some people with Vietnamese language. And so that was what happened.
Which was the question. Where did you pick up Vietnamese?
We studied it. Mm-hmm. That was the part I left out of Bao Lạc.
In the agricultural department.
Yeah, we studied Vietnamese there, too. Mm-hmm. We had a Vietnamese teacher. Yeah.
Right.
Phuc. Yeah. How could I miss that?
How could you miss that?
Well, yeah, we had private classes.
I knew that must have happened, but...
Yeah,
I,
but not as formally, and they didn't want to take out... because we'd taken those 3 months to study Cambodian.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want to have formal classes, so we just studied it as we taught.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was part of
But you were teaching there. English.
We were teaching English,
right.
Uh-huh.
And so did you leave directly from Hong Kong to Laos, or did you go back to the States?
Left from Hong Kong, mm-hmm. back over to Laos. But it took several months before we did. I lived in Hong Kong about 3 months.
Mm.
And I roomed with... that was very interesting. We got per diem there.
Mm-hmm.
And that was where my eyes were open as to who CIA people were and who wasn't, because the CIA wives got twice as much per diem as anybody else. And... so, you know, it was real clear, and everybody
Which
was talking about it.
Which one is the spy? Well, okay. That's the,
and so we learned that part of the people in public safety in Hue were CIA, and
mm-hmm.
and there were two, Sam Thompson was the consul, who was still good friends. Sam and Judy are actually from this area.
The consul in Hue?
In Hue, and were friends later in Laos.
Mm-hmm.
And then Tony Lake was the vice consul.
Counseling
and was mm-hmm. involved with the students, and that's where we first got to know them. They had their son Tim, and Sam and Judy had a little girl, and she had another son.
We're talking briefly here about Anthony Lake, who was vice consul in Hue, and who is currently serving as national security advisor to
mm-hmm.
President Clinton.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Sam went on, too, to a career in Foreign Service, and is now retired. And their family, their kids were around the age of Andrea, my daughter, that was born after we... That should wait till we get over to the Laos part. Have anything
we're
else
there.
Here?
No, we're almost
there.
Having experienced a brief experience of Cambodia, and then spent the better part of a year in...
Almost two.
Yeah.
All
of
64 and part of 65.
What were your feelings then about IBS and Southeast Asia?
I really believe that IBS was doing really important work in Southeast Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to see, because we sang, we got down to Canta, where Phil and Kathy Walker were.
That's another couple
we knew in college.
That's C-A-N-T-H-O is the way it's
yeah.
spelt in English, unfortunately.
And the Walkers also had gone to college with us, and were a bass and a soprano, so we sang with them. And I think it was USIS that sponsored us to go down to Canta. Down to visit the South. Also, we had an opportunity to go to My Tho with the Vietnamese volunteer group.
That's M-Y-T-H-O.
With a Vietnamese volunteer group that was the counterpart to IVS to give cholera shots.
Mm-hmm.
And although we didn't have the summer camp experiences with the Vietnamese students that other IVSers did.
Mm-hmm.
We could see that as a really beneficial program. Also, while we were in Hue, we took counterpart teachers.
Mm-hmm.
Kim Chi was mine that I worked with. And she, and we came to Saigon. That's where we learned about the problems of the teachers becoming activists in their schools. They were under the fear of maybe being transferred to, they made waves, mm-hmm. transferred out to the boonies. So the most activist teacher was Bui Chi, who was in Bami Tuit, and he couldn't be out any further. No. So he built a library. He was great, had conversation groups, and that was one of the things we were encouraging, was more work with students. And
Bui Chi, B-U-I-C-H-I.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And
Bami Tuit, you can get off the map.
Yes. And anyway, we had a conference there with teachers that was really beneficial, we thought. And
well, what did you think were the most beneficial of the things that IBS did?
Well, community development work. Mm-hmm. Let's see, Willie Myers was in Hue doing, I think, malaria control.
Mm-hmm.
I think the most, well, I would say we had some doubts, too, because of the escalation of the war, but not as many doubts as later arose.
Well, you probably left Vietnam before...
Before the Marines arrived.
Before March of 1965.
Yeah.
Right. But you... Do you?
Because it was by April or May that we went to Laos, mm-hmm. From Hong
right.
Kong. But Ron was still there. In fact, he was visiting Sam Thompson at the embassy in Saigon when it was blown up. Do you remember that picture? It's front page New York Times of an American coming out all bloodied because a grenade had been thrown into the bomb.
Ahead. Yes, I remember it very well.
Mm-hmm.
That photograph was of our friend Sam Thompson, the mm-hmm. consul from Hue, and I happened to be in Hong Kong at the time. Thinking, well, I'm glad that Ron's in Hue and wouldn't have been there at the time. And then, of course, later found out Ron was there, and he had been in Sam's office talking with him
mm-hmm.
and walked out just moments before this event happened. And so things were a little scary. Even though, and it's funny, living there, I didn't feel afraid. I was just aware that we weren't supposed to drive at night and that we followed certain, you know, precautions in our life. And, in fact, when we were in Japan at the seminar, I got real upset when Judy told me my cousin was coming up from Tokyo after dark. I said, you mean he's driving after dark? Well, that should be the end of that for a while. I also found out when I was living in Hong Kong that I had reactions to loud noises.
Startled.
That I wasn't startled things, that I wasn't aware of at the time we were living in Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
of the different of limitations and a fear that was there, but it wasn't conscious.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't conscious of my students. I was in a way, and I guess maybe it's just our own kind of self-protection, but I know I was teaching at Wintry Fung School, and the students came from outlying areas. It was not the upper-class boys' school that was in Hue, the famous high school there, Kukok. And I later realized that my students were coming in from areas that were being bombed and from living on boats. And you know how you, when you're teaching a class, it's just all business. You know, mm-hmm. You do the classes and you give them the tests and everything. And you know, later thinking about it, I'm amazed that those kids could just keep coming to school. It was kind of overwhelming because, as you saw in the pictures, there's 60 boys in a classroom. And so except for a few exceptional students, you didn't really get to learn to know all of them
mm-hmm.
as personally as would have been nice,
mm-hmm.
Although it would have been difficult because it was hard enough as it was knowing the stress that they were living under at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's no wonder that the university students were politically active because they lived in uncertain times, uncertain future. Mm-hmm. And my friend from Hue that was going to my school that lives in Hermosa has a fish market restaurant here, told me that he joined the Navy thinking he could get out to sea and get away, be away from the actual fighting.
Uh-huh. So, did it work?
Hmm?
Did it work?
Well, he was out there in 75 to be evacuated, mm-hmm. so it worked for him to get here, and he's met his wife here. Mm-hmm. He and many, or everybody has incredible stories to tell. Mm-hmm. But there was one thing that happened in Hue that the debate then was, of course, that leading up to bombing the North was, you know, should the North be bombed? And I overheard a lot of the discussions. But one of the things that happened that my Vietnamese counterpart teacher, Kim Chi, took me to see a display of weapons. There was a big cache of weapons that were taken from the river that were put on display, and it was advertised for everybody to go see that these were Chinese and Russian weapons, mm-hmm. and that they were backing the North Vietnamese and using this to gain support for, well, I guess, you know, we need to go and be more aggressive in the North, mm-hmm. because that's the only way it's going to stop what's happening down here. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until years later I read Ralph McGeehy's book, and he talks in it about how the CIA got these weapons out of a CIA warehouse and planted them on a barge on the river in Hue in order for them to be captured and displayed to gain support for escalating the war.
And you saw that display.
And I saw that display, and I went, oh my God, I fell for it. I thought at the time, well, you know, I guess.
Do you remember exactly when that was? Or
it was, it had to be early 65. Mm-hmm. Had to be early 65, because everything was in process there to expand the war, mm-hmm. because the Tonkin crisis happened that August while we were in Japan. And then, and this was kind of the debate among IVSers too, even people who were there who were not pro-war, just saying, you know, this is really bad and really hard on these people, mm-hmm. that we're trying to help. Mm-hmm. And